You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for East Asian Studies here at Brookings. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to our program today, The Rohingya Inside the Conflict in Myanmar's Rakhine State. Our speaker is Azim Ibrahim, who is the author of this book. I highly recommend it. It's very clearly argued, clearly written, and quite disturbing. Dr. Ibrahim has his doctorate from the University of Cambridge. He is an RAI fellow at Mansfield College, University of Oxford, and research professor at the Strategic Studies Institute, U.S. Army War College, and a lot of other things. Finally, he jumps out of airplanes, so he's to be taken very seriously. One of the odder newspaper articles that I read this year was in the New York Times, and it described an encounter between Aung San Suu Kyi and our ambassador to Myanmar, Scott Marcial. Now, I know Scott. He's a diplomat's diplomat. He does his job, but he does it in a non-provocative and inoffensive way. But Aung San Suu Kyi had a request of him, and that was to not use the word Rohingya. Don't use the word. Now, this is a bit mysterious, perplexing, but today we have the answer to the mystery and to the perplexity. And Dr. Ibrahim is going to explain this all and why we need to take it seriously. Azim?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that kind introduction, Richard. It's a great honour for me to be at this great institution. Let me start off with a historical quote. Naturally, the common people don't want war. But it's the leaders of that country who determine policy. And it's quite a simple matter to take the people along with you. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked, and it works the same in every country. Now, a sophisticated audience like this, you'll know that quote is from Field Marshal Hermann Göring, Hitler's vice chancellor. Now, today, these words may seem like the echoes of a bygone era, an era that was marked by persecution and genocide. And we instinctively feel that this is something that we have left behind. But how would we react to this kind of barbarism today? Now imagine the reports, imagine we started hearing reports of a mid-sized European country where there's tensions between the majority Christian population and a minority that lives within its borders. And just like the Jews of the 1930s, this minority is different. They look different. They have a different religion. They even speak a different language. And the initial reports start off with discrimination. Bus stations refusing to sell them tickets. Boycotts of their businesses. But as time goes on, the persecution gets more and more sinister. This minority is already undereducated, but then they are barred from schools, and then they're barred from hospitals. Then eventually they're barred from standing for election, and then barred from even voting. And there's some in public life that start to say that only Christians of this country can be loyal citizens. And then others start to say, well, these people, they were never citizens at all. They were never citizens in the first place. and this narrative starts to harden into conventional wisdom. Even the diplomats of this country start to say that this minority is actually physically inferior. And this minority is underrepresented internationally, so their voice is barely heard and their story is hardly told. Then the regional government starts to detain them in permanent internment camps and doesn't allow them to work. Then the religious clergy, the church, starts to incite hatred against them, and that is when the pogroms start, which then turn into massacres. Now imagine this country has an autocratic military government, and there's hope, and that hope rests in a great democratic leader. And soon this great democratic leader is released from house arrest, and there's cheers from around the world. At last, there is going to be change. The Democrats have won. And then there is nothing. The discrimination and the violence continue. Any hope that democracy will bring whole-scale change is now fading. Now, if this was a European country, we would shake our heads. We would lobby our representatives. Journalists would write shocking reports. They would ask tough questions. There will be petitions, protests in Parliament, in Congress, at the UN and elsewhere. But this is happening today, and there's hardly any criticism. There's hardly any red lines. It's happening not in Europe. It's happening to the Rohingya in Myanmar. Now, let me just step back and tell you how I got involved in all of this. I first heard of the Rohingya many years ago. And when I tried to find out more about them, I realised that there was a paucity of information about them. I knew that they were a persecuted people living in a remote part of the world. And compared to other groups, they received very little attention in the media and amongst from human rights groups and agencies. And when I went there and visited the region and went to the camps, I realised why. The Rohingya really are the lowest of the low of many of the persecuted groups that you can see. There are no Rohingya, there is nobody of Rohingya origin working in Silicon Valley who can say, you know, I will put $5 million of my money into a public awareness campaign. There's nobody of Rohingya origin working for the CNN or BBC that can say, look, I'm going to make this my pet project to raise awareness for the people. These people literally are the lowest of the low that you'll ever come across. They can't advocate for themselves in Myanmar, let alone internationally. So soon I realised that if I wanted to read anything of substance about them, anything authoritative, I'd probably have to write it myself. So I wrote a number of op-eds in various publications trying to raise awareness of the issue. And then I made a trip. I even wrote this memo that went to parliamentarians in the UK and to the European Parliament trying to highlight the persecution that's going on. I then made a trip out to the region. My first trip was to Bangladesh, to the camps in Bangladesh, where there's hundreds of thousands of Rohingya. And this is from the actual camps. And you can see the conditions that these people stay in are quite horrific and rudimentary. I took testimonials from people like this, from Fatima, whose husband was killed. He got a gash on his knee from a machete and died with an infection whilst running away. And people like Zubeda, who hasn't seen her three children for years. I also went to Myanmar itself and visited the Rohingya villages that have been completely emptied. This was a Rohingya village that's now been completely emptied, and the inhabitants internal displacement camps. And to get into these villages and then to get into the camps, you have to be smuggled. So this was my guide smuggling me into the camps. It cost about $200. And the camps itself, the conditions, as you can see, and that's the kind of conditions that people have to live in. And when it rains all the time. You're literally knee-high in human sewage and garbage. And there's no escape from the rain. This was my guide that smuggled me into the camps. And there's police patrolling the camps to make sure nobody gets out. And these are sites of mass graves. Like this one here, for example, when one house was burned down and all nine members of the Fon family were burned alive, the authorities literally piled them all into the back of a pickup truck and dropped them off at the camp into a pile, and the villagers in the camp buried them in this man's grave. So I did this research. I put together this book over the last 2.5 years, and I now believe that sooner or later we will wake up to a situation similar to the scale of Rwanda in 1994. Now, some say that the word genocide is very far-fetched, but I want to take the next few minutes to try to explain to you of what I've learned and the real risk that these people are facing. But before we do that, we have to take a step back and look at where all of this animosity actually came from. So Myanmar is a country of 51 million people in Southeast Asia. It's sandwiched between China, Laos, Thailand and Bangladesh. The trading links with India brought Islam to the region. Buddhism arrived about 800 AD. And much of the history is multi-confessional, with Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims all living side by side. Today it's about 80% Buddhist, 8% Christian and 4% Muslim. Now, the Rohingya are an ethnic group that are about 1 million in the Rakhine district, which is in the northwest. And some historians say that their roots go back to 3000 BC. In Myanmar, they're the largest minority. They look different, they have darker skin, and they live today as they have always lived, principally as fishermen and farmers. Now, one of the main accusations, despite the fact that these people have such strong roots in the region, is that these people aren't actually from Burma. They're not actually from Myanmar. For example, this is a newspaper cutting that the government does not recognise the term Rohingya, that it's a manufactured term. So one of the things I wanted to do with this book is to explore this idea that why, you know, this term not recognised. And so during my research for the book, I dug up some ancient historical documents, principally from the Indian National Archive in New Delhi. And this is one, for example, from 1799. One early explorer, Francis Buchanan, who referred to the Rohingya living in Arakan, in the Arakan state. 12 years later, the Classical Journal, so you see here the term Rohingya from 1799. 12 years later, the Classical Journal refers to the Rohingya as well. That's 1811. In 1815, the German Compendium of Languages also talks of the Rohingya as a distinct ethnic group. But the most interesting document I came across is this one here. In 1824, the British colonised what was at that time Burma and referred to the whole region as Rohang. And the inhabitants were referred to as Rovingo, Rohingya or Rohingya. In 1825, the British commissioned this one individual, Charles Patton, to undertake a survey of that whole region. And this is the original document which I dug up from New Delhi. And you can see here, it's very clear. So that's the text, original text on the left-hand side and the translation on the right. You can see here, it says Musulman, three-tenths of every soul is a Muslim in that region, which is the exact same proportion of it today. It's about 30,000, and the peasantry spoke the language of Rohingya. So where does this animosity come from? This is clear historical evidence that these people have deep roots from multiple sources in that region, whereas you have the extremists saying that these people have absolutely no relation to this country at all, and they're all illegal immigrants from Bangladesh from the 1920s. We have to look back at where this animosity actually started. It actually started in World War II when the Japanese invaded Burma at that time. The Burmese nationalists, the majority Buddhist population, decided to side with the Japanese invaders because they thought that would get them independence from the British much quicker, whereas the Rohingya supported the British colonial masters. 2 years later, when the war ended, many of the Rohingya wanted to join East Pakistan, which was at that time Bangladesh, and that led to violence between the two groups. By 1948, Myanmar had become independent, but there was still a legacy of bad blood between the Buddhist and the Rohingya. And then from 1948, for about 15 years, they had quite some peace, and it was a relatively functioning democracy. But the tipping point, the change really came in 1962, when General Ne Win organised a military coup and the country became an autocratic military dictatorship up until the 21st century. And since then, the anti-Rohingya sentiment has become very ugly. In 1974, the regime wrote a constitution describing the Rohingya as foreigners. And one of the things that the General Ne Win tried to do, he tried to implement an economic plan called the Burmese Road to Socialism, which was a complete economic disaster. And he did what almost all military dictators do, is that when things don't go well, you start blaming somebody else. You start blaming the enemy within. And the Rohingya were the target of choice because they look different and they speak a different language. So he did, essentially, he started to become very similar to what many Middle Eastern leaders do. When things start going wrong, they start to don the cloak of religiosity, just like Saddam did after the first Gulf War. They changed the flag and they put Islamic terminology in it. You know, they start becoming more religious. And this is what they did. He essentially started to fund monasteries, started to become much more Buddhist, and started to equate Buddhist identity with being Burmese. And in 1974, they wrote this constitution that described the Rohingya as all of them as foreigners. And this violence followed. And many tried to leave during that time, and that created a huge refugee crisis. But then the main difficulty came in 1982 with the new citizenship law of Burma, which essentially said that there have been no Rohingya in the entire history of Burma. And this regime continuously repeated this lie until now it is widely believed. By 1988, 6 years later, there was a popular revolt which forced Ne Win, the general, to stand down. But his regime stayed intact, stayed in power. And it became even more ethnocentric. And they began to say that only Buddhists can be loyal citizens of this country. And this created this deadly cocktail of historical grievances and officially sanctioned religious ethnic discrimination proved murderous for the Rohingya. By the 1990s, the generals allowed a general election, which they lost, so they ignored the results. And by 91 to 92, there was more military attacks, with 250,000 Rohingya fleeing to Bangladesh and Malaysia. By 2012, that was a more sustained period of violence. And the last year elections, which we all seen on our TV screens, the generals competed as politicians. And the elections were seriously flawed. It was still a step in the right direction, but they were seriously flawed because the military still controls a quarter of all the seats in parliament. There was inaccurate voting lists, and 5% of the population, including 1 million Rohingya, weren't allowed to vote. And the military today controls the most powerful ministries, the Interior Ministry and the Defence Ministry, and they have an ability to dissolve parliament whenever they want. But nevertheless, the elections brought Aung San Suu Kyi to power. And this heralded a new dawn, a new change. But for the Rohingya, it changed nothing. One Rohingya member of parliament, former member of parliament, who was essentially forbidden to stand again, told me, "If people are in hell, Rohingya are at the bottom of hell. Myanmar government made policy by using race, religion, nationality, and almost all Myanmar ethnic have hatred against Rohingya and hatred against Islam. And accusing collectively these people are illegal immigrants." The most sustained period of violence was 2012-2013. And this is when it really did reach very high levels of killing of the Rohingya. And this is a story of untold brutality. In spring 2012, one Rakhine woman was raped and murdered. And the Rohingya were blamed for this. So the extremist Buddhists stopped a bus and killed 10 random Rohingya on the bus. Weeks afterwards, the entire region descended into violence. Human Rights Watch reported mobs, arson and murder. And soon local security forces also joined in the attacks. And in some areas, the mobs were actually joined by the army itself. The state refused to help or even investigate what's going on. And President Thein Sein at the time said that Rohingya should therefore be sent to a third country in order to protect them. And this is now part of the anti-Rohingya sentiment, that they should all be sent to a third country. And this hate was fanned by the Buddhist extremists. Individuals like this, Wirathu, who's described himself as a Buddhist bin Laden. The Buddhists exert extreme influence in this region. This entire region is dominated by religious organizations. The monks and monastery exert considerable influence. Now, one of the questions that I get asked all the time is that, you know, Buddhism, as we know, is a very peaceful religion. These are people that don't even kill insects. So how could they possibly perpetuate and inflame such violence? But this is a different form of Buddhism. This is what they call Theravada Buddhism. They don't actually recognize the Dalai Lama. When the Dalai Lama visited Myanmar, he was actually given a cold shoulder by many of the monks. So this form of Buddhism is very different in that they feel, they believe that in order for Buddhism to be safe, all other ideologies and ethnicities have to be kept in check and have to be kept a close eye on. And Buddhism will only thrive and be safe when all of them are kept in check. And there's other extreme ethnocentric groups in the Rakhine district that are spreading violence. One name that continuously came up when I was on the ground there was of this individual here, Dr. A. Mong from the Arakan National Party. His name continuously came up on almost every person that I spoke to. Along with extreme Buddhist organizations like the 969 Movement, the Patriotic Association of Myanmar, these are organizations that are responsible for almost all the religious education in that region. They act as power brokers for the big national parties, and they use that power and influence against the Rohingya. So the main national parties, like Aung San Suu Kyi's parties, for example, has almost no traction in the Rakhine district. This small region is dominated just by local parties. So for them to try to make some sort of headway in that region, they have to make deals with the local kind of parties. I even heard of a case of one charity which wanted to undertake cleft lip surgeries for children in that region, but you have to get permission from the monasteries. And when the charity told them that, look, we're going to treat everybody equally, the monasteries refused. They said, if you treat the Rohingya, we don't want our children treated either. So there's a campaign to ensure that the Rohingya don't have access to healthcare, education or travel. And if they want access to such facilities, they have to convert to Buddhism. And these extreme Buddhists are continuously distributing pamphlets to stop trading with the Rohingya, an echo of the Nazi race laws. It's quite obvious. So in October 2012, there's a new wave of violence which was much more organised and systematic. Houses and local community centres were burnt. And in one day, there was a coordinated attack in five districts when even Buddhists were killed. One of the worst incidents was in the village of Yanti, which is this one here. And one of the survivors told me that local police told us to go back to village and took sticks from our hands. Told us, don't do anything, we will protect you. So we trusted them. But broke that promise. Arakanese beat and killed us very easily. Some survivors say that the police opened fire on them. Amongst the dead were 28 children. 13 of them were under 5 years old, hacked to death. And in some places, the police prevented the violence. And in other places, the police actually participated in the violence. So since that time, in April 2014, the UN Special Rapporteur to the Secretary General said that there has been no improvement in the human rights situation and there's a lack of clear action at the state and national level to address the widespread discrimination and human rights violation. No state official has ever been held to account, and Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the NLD, has been silent, and the result has been another refugee crisis. And since then, the violence has occasionally flared up, like in the village of Duki Radan, where 4,000 Rohingya have been killed, raped, arrested, or are simply missing. And the media attention has been very sparse as well. The regime revokes the NGO access to any NGOs which speak out, and this violence had left many Rohingya in refugee camps with no education, healthcare, or precarious work. And there's evidence that the regime has decided to make these IDP camps permanent. They've even organised a census. And if you refuse to participate in that census, you're either detained or you're deported. But the catch is, if you register, you have to declare that you're a Bengali and not Rohingya. therefore renouncing your own citizenship, meaning that you can actually be deported. Today, there's 140,000 of them in camps like this, with no official documentation and restrictions on travel and restrictions on family size. Hospitals refuse to treat them, and if you try to flee, the only way you can do so is through rickety boats like this, through people smugglers, who then sell them to the slave trade in Thailand in the prawn industry. In the first 6 months of 2015, 31,000 Rohingya fled in such conditions. The UNHCR estimates that between October 2012 and April 2013, 13,000 arrived in Malaysia and 6,000 arrived in Thailand. Thai officials have been known to be complicit, collecting Rohingya from traffickers and transporting them to the camps to be sold. One individual told me, they told me I was going to work in a pineapple factory, but when I saw the fishing boats, I realised I'd been sold. I was so depressed, I wanted to die. There have been moves to help them. The Indonesian Navy, for example, agreed to help the boats that are stuck in troubled waters. Myanmar did try to stop the border, to stop the boats from leaving because so many of them were sinking. But neither action gets to the root of the problem, which is the discrimination and the denial of citizenship. Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel laureate, who kindly wrote the introduction to my book, said, "Rejection of citizenship, denial of freedom of movement, eviction campaigns, violence against women, forced labour, expulsion from their lands and property have made the Rohingya the most persecuted minority in the world. And these words have been echoed by the United Nations. So finally, what can actually be done? First of all, this isn't a problem without a solution. The demands are very clear. You have to shut down the camps and allow the Rohingya to return home. Outsiders have to stand up to the regime. But above all, these are people that are citizens of Myanmar and have to be treated accordingly. Now, some organisations will say, and some, you know, diplomats I met say, that look, this is a localised problem within the borders of a sovereign state. There's nothing much that we can do about it. And I would say that's wrong, because it's only outsiders can actually make a difference. The Rohingya are never going to be a majority in their own country. So there's essentially five things that I think that we can do to help. First of all, we have to change how we think about Myanmar. When we hear the words Palestine, Tibet, Kurdistan, Crimea, these are countries where they have issues, fundamental issues, still to be resolved. We have to add Myanmar to that list. The story of Myanmar, of a small, brave country opening up its markets, opening up its mind to democracy, hides the religious discrimination, the violence and the massacres. That is also part of the story of Myanmar. And we can't let the government buy the silence with this good narrative that they're trying to promote. Those politicians who don't criticise it don't set red lines. They are failing in their duty in international law. Secondly, we can raise the profile of the issue. Some UN agencies and NGOs are monitoring the situation, but the internal affairs of this small country, little known country, hardly captures the global imagination, global attention. Even the crisis in 2015, when they were all stuck on the boats, which became headline news, even that was portrayed as a Southeast Asian migration crisis, and the cause of the crisis was barely mentioned. And this is what's needed to change. We have to put the plight of the Rohingya on the map. Journalists have to write articles about this. Photographers and newspapers must try to put this on the front page. And documentaries must explain the situation. Campaigners have to take the story to campuses, streets and parliament. When a minority group like the Rohingya are hated so much, sometimes the only thing that's preventing mass killing is international opinion. An organisation like, for example, Queen Mary University State Crime Initiative have said that the Rohingya are now at the final stages of genocide. This is an academic paper. And this is the same as Yale University's study. They said that what the Rohingya are experiencing is technically a genocide. And this issue has received some attention. Former Prime Minister David Cameron and President Obama made some short mention of the issues in speeches. The Dalai Lama, the Pope, the UN Secretary General also mentioned it. But it's still a long way to go. Another thing we could do is have petitioned politicians in Myanmar directly. Because the central demand is very simple. The Rohingya were born in Myanmar, they live in Myanmar, and they have a right to citizenship in Myanmar. And we have to call upon the government of Myanmar to grant it. Myanmar is, after all, a UN member. Citizenship is a right, is not a privilege. And the UN Convention on Citizenship is very clear that no state can render stateless people that have been born within its territory. In the short term, it's unlikely that a foreign state or international body is going to force Myanmar to change its position. But that is certainly not a reason not to start, and the pressure has to be maintained. In the first year of election, Aung San Suu Kyi, when she became leader, when she's pressed upon the situation of the Rohingya, she gives boilerplate responses, which is simply not appropriate way to talk about massacres that are happening in your country. Worst, even worse, is when she is talking to a home audience, she simply does not challenge the extremist narrative that the Rohingya are all foreigners. She does not even use the word Rohingya and refers to them as Bengalis, meaning that they can all essentially be deported. Francis Buchanan from 1799 will be totally baffled by this position. Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, knows that her political capital comes from an international reputation that she has built as a democracy icon, as a Nobel laureate. And the task of campaigners is to try to persuade her to change her position and ensure her evasiveness carries a political price. Another thing we could do is ask our leaders and diplomats and our government to give the backing to the ASEAN initiative. The Asian Association has traditionally, the ASEAN has traditionally never got involved in the affairs, internal affairs of a member country. But the Rohingya issue was so serious that it abandoned its policy and demanded that Rohingya be given full rights. ASEAN parliamentarians have put the issue of the Rohingya as a permanent item on their agenda. Malaysia, Indonesia and others know that this repression of the Rohingya has created a refugee crisis which they simply cannot manage. And as long as the international community stays silent, this nod of approval, this refugees will continue to flow. This cartoon, for example, shows what the situation was like in 2015 when the Rohingya were all stuck out in boats, which nobody wanted. And the ASEAN demand is very simple. They want internal observers to be placed in Myanmar. And that sends a very powerful message to the next mob that wants to instigate violence, that the eyes and ears of the world are upon you. And it's a powerful way to challenge some of the rumours and to send a strong message that your era of impunity is over. Another thing we could do is to move direct. There's only a handful of people who can have a direct impact, more so than anybody else, and that's prosecutors at the ICC, which is the only body that can prosecute individuals for these kinds of crimes. Prosecutors can initiate an investigation against individuals responsible for building up this kind of hatred. They could be faced charges of preparing and inciting genocide and crimes against humanity. The threat of legal action, just the threat, sends a very powerful statement that you are not immune from prosecution. And it's a wider lesson to the local Rakhine parties that domestic national politics is not going to protect you from accountability. And this change must focus attention on individuals like Dr. Among, who I mentioned earlier. So in conclusion, the story of the Rohingyas is a story that is replete with the echoes of history. When I started off with the quote, naturally, common people don't want war, but it's easy to take them along. All you have to do is tell them that they are victims and they are being attacked. I started off with the words of Hermann Göring because there's an uncanny resonance with what is happening today. And when we look back, history shows that we were right to stand up to the Nazis. And it's obvious that we should have stood up in Rwanda in 94. But history shows that we now know enough about genocides and how they happen. They don't happen in a vacuum. It takes years and years to build up that kind of hatred. so we know also how to prevent them. And the lesson I take from all of this is that when the internal political constraints of mass killing have all gone, the only one check, final check on full-scale genocide is usually international opinion. And I am determined that to make that in future, we do not all say to ourselves that we should have acted much sooner. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Razim, for that very powerful statement. I have a couple of questions more of background and context, and then we'll open it up. First of all, you explain in your book, and I'd like you to explain for the audience, the way in which the Rohingya issue is, in a way, a legacy of the way the British drew borders.
Yeah. See, it was very interesting for me because... When I was digging up some of the archival documents that the British had from the National Archives in New Delhi, there was a number of things that struck me. First of all, the most important thing that struck me, which really came as a real surprise, is how organised the British were when it came to colonising some of these countries. It was absolutely astonishing. You know, back in the 18th century, this entire region was just a jungle, and they sent, you know, expert civil servants down there to figure out exactly what the makeup of this region is, you know, who's actually living there, who are the clan chiefs, who are the tribes, mm-hmm. and what is their lineage and where do they come from before they actually sent in the colonizers, you know, and that really explains why they were so effective that over a quarter of the world mm-hmm. came under British rule. The Brits were extremely, extremely effective mm-hmm. in colonizing a lot of these unknown kind of regions. One of the things with the British is that they were very expert, and when they moved into these regions, they usually put a minority population, gave them the reins of power, so that minority population is completely reliant on the support of the British to stay in power. And you can see some of that around the world today. And you can see it with the Alawites in Syria, for example, that they know that if they step down, that there's going to be some real trouble for them. And they did the same thing in Burma as well, is that they put a lot of the administrators in India as well, in Burma, they put the Muslims in charge, which mm-hmm. were a minority, and the Muslims were much better at the administration. And for them, it was a complete cold calculation in terms of how to get the maximum utility in terms of focusing and establishing their colonial kind of power. But one thing they weren't interested in, one thing the Brits weren't interested in is actually creating ethnic strife. You know, they were much more interested in creating an effective administration, you know. And the legacy of the Brits when drawing up borders between various countries is well known for us today. You know, one just has to look at the Middle East and Africa, is that they literally drew lines between ethnic groups without giving any consideration to them at all. And many of those lines aren't recognised, whether it's in Rakhine District in Myanmar or East Bangladesh or even Afghanistan is the classic example. You know, you go to Afghanistan, the Durand Line is completely unknown to the Pashtos. The Pashtos mm-hmm. live on both sides, so it's completely unknown. So much of the problems do come down to the inability of the British colonial masters to fully appreciate the importance of ethnicity over nationality. Mm-hmm. And you go to these regions, you know, whether it's Burma or elsewhere, people who still identify themselves according to the tribe and according to the clan, because that has been their identity for thousands of years, whereas these borders, colonial borders, were only, you know, drawn up by foreigners, and which they simply don't recognise today, and you know, and they don't intend to.
You may have a physical map. Sure. Let me ask another question about minorities more broadly.
Yeah.
The Rohingya obviously are not the only minority in Myanmar, and there are lots of other ones, but it seems that the Rohingya are a special case in the way the Burman majority deals with its minority populations.
Well, the Rohingya are the largest of the minorities. There's multiple minorities in Myanmar. And the Rohingya are also not the only Muslim minority as well. There's also other actual ethnic Burmese, with the ethnic Burmese look minority Muslim population, who aren't discriminated against to the same extent. But almost all minorities, whether it's a Sikh, you know, they also have a Christian population, Sikh, Hindus, they all get some sort of discrimination. The fundamental problem with the Rohingya is that they are from the Rakhine district. And the Rakhine district is essentially the poorest district in Myanmar itself. And so it's already backward, it's already underdeveloped. So in a situation like this, and they're looked down upon by the rest of the Burmese. So they're already in a situation, the Rakhines in general, that they're being discriminated against. So in a situation like that, it's very easy to say, well, look, the roots of your problem are not because of you being in Rakhine. It's basically these foreigners that look different that are the roots of all your problems. So it's very easy to discriminate against them because they look different. They're already from an impoverished region. And you can easily make them target of choice, which is what's happened.
Yeah. Okay. So let's open it up. We'll have a mic, so wait for the mic, identify yourself, and pose your question. Who'd like to go first? Here, right here.
Hi, my name's Louis Goundon. I'm a high school student here, a junior at the School for Ethics and Global Leadership. And you talked about how many Rohingyans are refugees fleeing persecution, and given that the persecution is unlikely to end soon in the next couple of years, I was wondering if you could give us a window into the minds of many of these refugees. What is their goal? Do they want to return? Do they want to leave Myanmar and never return? Is there a country that they're specifically trying to get to? And what's the makeup of these? Are they more young men? Are they families? Thank you.
Great question. Thank you very much. When I was in Myanmar, actually, I was offered the opportunity to join one of the boats to actually see the routes that the traffickers were using. But when I seen the boat, you know, I clearly declined. That boat was not going to get very far. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just complete junk. But that is the situation of the Rohingya, that so many are leaving on a large scale. You've seen the photo that I put up. You know, they're literally crammed in. Many of the Rohingya that I spoke to, including in Bangladesh and Malaysia, you know, they all want to go back to their country. You know, when the situation improves, which is unlikely to happen in the foreseeable future, the majority of them, they're actually a makeup. You know, there's many families, there's many females, there's many males, and all of them face a very, very difficult future because countries like Malaysia, Bangladesh, Thailand, and so on simply do not have the infrastructure or the desire to support them in any way. So as I mentioned in my presentation, they're literally sold into the slave trade. And then the entirety of the Thai prawn trade is almost run on the back of the Rohingya slaves. They're literally kept as slaves in the boats. With a lot of the females, they're literally sold into prostitution, and you know, sold as domestic slaves, and you see that very widespread in Thailand and Malaysia, and in terms of the numbers, there's no precise number because the actual number of Rohingya is estimated between 1.4 to 2 million, and because they're not even recognised as being citizens, you know, there's no way of actually determining how many they are. But in the camps itself, you know, the camps I visited, there's about 140,000 of them. And almost everyone I came across wanted to leave one way or another. And it was just a question of trying to pay the traffickers to try to help them to leave that situation.
Has UNHCR tried to get access to Rohingya in order to screen them for refugee status?
As far as I'm aware, when I was there, the UNHCR was only the ones that actually made it to abroad. Yeah, so the ones that actually made it to Malaysia, some of them were given refugee status through an extensive process and then, you know, rehoused in some European countries and even in the United States. You know, there's a Rohingya center in Chicago, which I visited. So some of those that have made it to Thailand and Malaysia and so on. But obviously the ones that are still internally displaced in the camps in Myanmar, they're not recognized as refugees.
Okay. Oh, lots of questions. Okay. Let's start in the back and move towards the front.
Hi, my name is Allison Glick. I'm with the Government Accountability Project. I think you have a very sound analysis in terms of situating the, what's going on in terms of ethnic strife. But I was surprised that you didn't talk about the role of the Sitwe deep sea port and how clearing out the Rohingya basically gave access to the interests who were wanting to build that port for oil and gas and other mineral exploitation. Don't you think that in addition to the 5 points and five things and areas of responsibility, shouldn't there be responsibility for the multinational corporations who are benefiting from that port that was only constructed after the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya, and particularly the role of not only China and India, but even U.S. companies who are benefiting? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Allison. Another great question. You're absolutely right. Some of the villages I visited are completely cleansed. Completely, everybody was moved out. And in many cases, some of the villages were demolished. In other cases, actual Buddhists moved in and started occupying occupied the houses. And in some cases, it was a very interesting case I came across, and this was back in 2013 or 2012, I think, in which they moved the Rohingya into camps, and then from the camps, they moved them into an area which is on the coast. And it was very interesting they did that, because this was when the hurricane was coming, and they decided to move all of the Rohingya directly into the path of the hurricane in the hope that they would be wiped out. You know, so that's the calculation of the thinking in Sitwe. One of the questions I get asked quite often is the role of the United States. You know, President Obama visited Myanmar just a couple of years ago. And for any country to get a visit from the President of the United States is quite a big deal. And even Aung San Suu Kyi, she visited, you know, the US and the UN recently. And I get asked, you know, what role of the United States? See, the narrative of Aung San Suu Kyi is a very attractive one. And this is what I have found, you know, speaking on this topic on the radio and TV. It's a very attractive narrative. Now, you have a lady here who's the daughter of one of the founding generals of Myanmar. Who's one of the great leaders of Myanmar. She was placed under house arrest for decades by this brutal military dictatorship. And now she's out of prison. Yeah, she's a Nobel laureate, Oxford educated, very beautiful, very articulate. Now she's opening up her country to democracy, human rights, you know, becoming an internationalist, an international icon. Now, people don't want that narrative to be contaminated when you start mentioning things like the Rohingya. People like to have their stories very, very clean. They like to have their fairy tales, essentially. And you start mentioning the Rohingya and the persecution, the massacres, and she's not doing anything about it. She's silent, you know, and people just don't like that at all. And in terms of the role of the United States, I'd say the US is focusing on much larger geopolitical machinations. Myanmar, even when it was a military dictatorship, was a very close society. They were extremely suspicious of foreigners. And as it opens up, one thing that the US is quite concerned about is that it comes in the sphere of influence of China. Chinese are the biggest investors in Myanmar by far. The entire Southeast Asia is now being economically redeveloped for that main purpose is to meet Chinese insatiable demand for resources. Now, you go to Pakistan, as I have, you see the highways and the bridges and the ports that they're building, and it's all just to meet Chinese demand. And exactly the same thing in Myanmar as well. So there's a much larger geopolitical story here, and there's much larger economic interests as well. And then you start mentioning the Rohingya, but this small minority that's been persecuted and so on. People just don't want to hear that at all. You know, they just don't want the narrative to be contaminated, and certainly they don't want the larger geopolitical interests to be diluted in any shape or form.
As I understood the question, that there's a connection between the treatment of the Rohingya and a specific oil and gas project. Is that the case?
I've heard of that oil and gas project. I couldn't find too much information about it if it's directly related, you know, and so I can't make that claim that it's directly related to the evacuation of the Rohingya from that particular region. Yeah, so I couldn't find any direct correlation. But I am aware that, you know, that there's considerable investment pouring in from China in that region.
Okay, a question there on the aisle.
Hi, my name is Tanya Burneth. I'm an independent consultant, but I worked in Myanmar with the Rohingya, with Management on Frontier in 2013. And I had a couple questions for you. I wondered if you had a chance to speak with any of the Rakhine people, not necessarily the leaders, but the like just the local population, you know, and do you see working with them as part of the solution also? That's one of my questions. Also, in 2013 and after the 2012 violence, you know, Human Rights Watch, I think they had so many reports, public reports. The UN had a lot of public reports. And it somehow didn't feel like it had an impact. And organizations, as you mentioned in your talk, you know, organizations like Medicine Sans Frontières and others were, you know, always, I guess, planned to speak out more, but were afraid to because they felt that they would get kicked out. And I just wondered from your perspective,